Hello, thank you. My name is Glenn. Thank you for joining me today on this great Thursday after lunch. Hopefully you can all stay awake. I've seen a bunch of you are very familiar to me, so hopefully that means I've been doing a good job and you're back to see me again. I work at Microsoft on the ASP.NET team, so I work a lot at the moment on ASP.NET Core. I've worked a lot on DNX and those parts of the stack, if those words mean anything to you. However, just before all that started, I also worked for a while on the Entity Framework team, particularly on the Entity Framework 6 release. So when we needed somebody to do the EF talk today, given that I was the one with the most Entity Framework experience, I was nominated. And so I'm here to talk to you about Entity Framework today on Rowan Miller's laptop over here. But my slides are running on my Mac. So let's get cracking and start talking about some stuff. A little while ago, a couple of years ago, before I even left basically the Entity Framework team, we were talking about Entity Framework everywhere. We had this kind of idea. We want Entity Framework to work in as many places as we can possibly make it. It's just a library, it's just a DLL. We want to make that DLL function everywhere. It's not one DLL, but you know, it's logically a single library that you can use, and you should be able to use it in as many places as possible. As we were thinking about it at the time, and as Entity Framework aligned to all the other names that were happening at Microsoft at the time, we thought Entity Framework, this new Entity Framework we're working on, it's kind of like the next evolution of Entity Framework. It's a major version shift, obviously, because there's lots of changes, but you know, we can make big arbitrary breaking changes in a major version change. Let's call it EF7, and we'll go from there. And that was okay, except that it implies in everybody's head, the number 7 at the end of Entity Framework implies a superset of 6. Maybe a superset plus some changes, but it doesn't imply that I've removed a whole bunch of stuff that you used to be able to do. Right? Does anybody disagree with that? Right, so that became a little bit confusing for people. So as we started to get to, so then we came with a new rename. That confusion lasted for a while, and it was the same with ASP.NET. And then we came to this core name, this kind of wave name, which is add core to all the things for a little while, and that makes sense, and then reset them to version 1. So now what we're talking about today is Entity Framework Core, version 1. And version 1 is an important thing with that. And it's a very interesting name because it's Entity Framework, which you're familiar with, but it's got this word core in it, and we've gone back to version 1, which we want to talk a bit about. So for the agenda today, we're going to introduce Entity Framework Core. I'm going to talk about Entity Framework Core and Entity Framework 6. There'll be a bunch of direct comparisons, particularly in the performance demonstrations about the performance of EF Core and Entity Framework 6, and hopefully give you some idea of where the two fit together and how things stand. Hopefully to answer the questions that I know a few of you have got. And then at the end, we'll give you links to docs and stuff like that. So let's introduce Entity Framework Core. So, as Rowan likes to say, this slide is all about how, for the last year, 8 years or so, we've been confusing all of our customers while we learn how to ship software. Because obviously, the very first version of a product that you ship should be called Entity Framework 3.5 Service Pack 1, right? That seems to make sense. In our case, we justified this by saying Entity Framework was part of the .NET framework. So the Entity Framework version number was always going to be the same as the version number of the .NET framework that you installed it with. Just so happens 3.5 Service Pack 1 was the first version of the .NET framework that had Entity Framework in the box. And that was the way we built software at this time, which was we've got everything and we put it into the .NET framework and you installed a gigabyte of .NET framework on your machine and then you had the world and life was glorious. Right? And tooling was in Visual Studio, and everything was just in the box and set up. And then we had this little this phase in the middle where we said we had Entity Framework 3.5 and Entity Framework 4, and we started to produce some new APIs on top. This was the beginning of DB Context. Is people familiar with DB Context? Some of you. So we started to produce some new APIs, new ways of interacting and working with Entity Framework. Some of those were on NuGet. and we could rev them faster than the .NET framework, because obviously we don't ship a .NET framework every 2 months. But it was even more confusing than starting your version number range at 3.5 was the fact that some of your products come with a .NET framework, some of it didn't, some of it you could install via NuGet and get upgrades to quickly, and some of it was installed in Visual Studio, and some of it you could get from Download Center, and it was kind of all over the place a little bit. And then Entity Framework isn't the only people that were in this spot. This dark blue is basically a transitionary phase where we moved from being fully inside the .NET framework to fully outside of the .NET framework. Because we wanted Entity Framework. Entity Framework doesn't have to be tied to the life cycle of the .NET framework, and it could rev faster and independently. So tying ourselves to it kind of arbitrarily almost from the beginning turned out not to necessarily be the best thing for EF, or for you guys, because you weren't able to get features fast enough. So Entity Framework 6 was where we got all of the runtime onto NuGet, all of the tooling was on Download Center, and every time there was a VS release, it would always have whatever the latest versions of all the tooling was inside the box. Right? Well, it was pretty good. Entity Framework 6 is about where I started. I'll take credit for all of it, even though I had nothing to do with it. So I worked on Entity Framework during this Entity Framework 6 period. And then at this same time as when we shipped Entity Framework 6 was also when Entity Framework went open source for the very first time. And so in typical fashion, there's this place called GitHub. Some of you might have heard of it, where all the people in the world go to do open source. So obviously, we created our own thing called Coplex and put Entity Framework on that. And then this release of Entity Framework 6 is still going. I think the current shipped version on NuGet might be 6.1.3, I want to say, 6.1.3. There's a 6.1.2 coming. So this kind of wave of Entity Framework existing and going is still there. Okay, and then we have this other thing called Entity Framework Core. It is on GitHub, where all the people are, and it is effectively file new project, let's make an ORM that looks like Entity Framework. So they both exist independently of each other, deliberately. Entity Framework 6 will keep going. This is kind of the overall story with Core, is there's a lot of the existing stuff keeps going, and we have some new stuff over here. But the thing with Entity Framework is that it is never the intent that Entity Framework Core will have every single feature that Entity Framework 6 has, or the other wave of Entity Framework. But we will deliberately not put stuff in. And I'll talk a little bit more about that, hopefully. So let's talk about some of the reasons why Entity Framework Core should be a thing. Why would you do this? Everybody knows that rewriting your application from scratch, much as everybody in this room would love to do it, isn't the right business decision to make. Is that correct? How many of you are trying to convince your boss right now to rewrite the application that you work on every day? How many of you have your boss say, I can't justify that to any of the people that buy our product? Yeah. Okay, so what were the reasons? And there was a lot of reasons. Some of them were good. Entity Framework 6, this is the stack diagram of .NET, right? You have the .NET framework, you have .NET Core, you have Xamarin. Entity Framework 6 sits down here in this runtime components section. And as you can see here, the .NET Core and the Xamarin kind of grayed out then when Entity Framework 6 appeared down the bottom right. The reason is because with Entity Framework 6, it's part of the .NET framework. It can only work where the .NET framework can run, the full .NET 4. Blah framework. Which means it doesn't work anywhere effectively other than, you can't really use Entity Framework anywhere other than, you know, WPF, WinForms, ASP.NET, the stuff, all of the existing frameworks and application models that you've known today, right? But there's all this other stuff happening. There's .NET Core, there's UWP, there's ASP.NET Core. You've got Xamarin stuff of iOS and Android. And Entity Framework is as a library, makes sense for Entity Framework to try and be able to be used in all of those places. So regardless of where you were trying to write C#, you can use Entity Framework to access data in that environment. Right? Seems like a pretty good thing for an ORM to do, for a data access technology to do. So with Entity Framework Core, we said, okay, we want Entity Framework Core to be able to work everywhere where eventually, ideally, everywhere where C# can work, or .NET can work, really, not C#. When I say C#, if there's any VB fans in here, I'm not explicitly denying VB. It's realistically anywhere .NET work, anywhere we can make .NET Core work, or F-sharp for that matter. Okay, so for those of you who wanted to play along today, I think there are some issues with Identity Framework Core today on some of the Xamarin stuff on the far right, but the intent is by 1.0 of Identity Framework Core, basically every box, you'll be able to use EF Core in every one of these boxes. Does that make sense? Is anybody buying the rewrite story yet? Do you think that justifies the, no? Maybe? Okay. New data stores. One of the other things is that Identity Framework today is very tightly tied to a relational to domain mapping, right? Object, it's object relational mapping, right? ORM. So we want Identity Framework Core to also work for non-relational data stores. We want you to be able to write DB context code against Mongo or table storage or whatever. But we didn't want it to be this crazy magical abstraction where you didn't even know what type of database it was under the covers and everything would just work for you and it was amazing and everybody applauded. That sort of stuff demos really well. Makes my job look really easy because I can go like, look, I'm going to write some code and now I'm going to swap five databases underneath and look, it's amazing, right? And then you try and use it in the real world and it's really, really not amazing. So instead, the way we went is that EF Core has some fundamental services and abstractions that are kind of useful regardless of where what sort of data store you're at. The ability to write link and then have link translated to some language that then executes natively against your data store and then returns some objects back to you, that's valuable. Kind of regardless of what data you're trying to get. It's valuable even if you're trying to load some data from a CSV file, right? So there's a bunch of common abstractions. And then there's some non-common concerns. Things that deal explicitly with relational concepts or explicitly with document database concepts or flat file concepts. I don't even know if flat file providers are a thing, but let's just throw that out there. And they will be specific to that. So as an example, we have SQL Server, SQLite, Postgres, SQL Compact. This relational line is what the focus is for now for Identity Framework Core, in that they are building it such that all the other non-relational abstractions will come in, but we're not going to like explicitly build one and give it to you for Mongo, for example, off day or DocumentDB. However, we do have a storage provider for Azure Table Storage. It was written by an intern as their intern project, and we've kind of maintained it, but we deliberately took resources away in order to focus on getting the relational story out for 1.0 before we move on to like making Azure Table Storage a thing, right? So that's all this stuff exists, but it's not necessarily going to be like 1.0 RTM along with everything else. We have a Redis provider. This was, I think, the very first prototype that would eventually that kind of prove the concept that we could eventually build this thing called EF Core, I believe, was a Redis. Was a Redis provider in order to, because it seemed like the furthest thing away from a relational data store that we could make. Right. There's also an in-memory provider. This does exist right now and is really, really good for testing. How many of you have been waiting for an in-memory provider for Identity Framework forever? Okay. So now there's ways, so now you can actually have your same DB context and you can pass in configuration to say use in memory or you can pass in configuration to use like SQL. I have a demo later that shows some of the patterns for how you can do that, but it effectively means you can pass in an in-memory provider and it just executes its stuff against like a dictionary in memory. I won't show you the in-memory provider, but I'll show you some of the patterns for how you can use a single DB context with two different database providers. But yeah, as I mentioned earlier on, just relational providers for V1 is what the focus is, because we need to focus on some subset of the entire world in order to ship a V1, since we've never shipped an Entity Framework V1 before. Okay. So let's talk about some new features that we were never really able to implement in Entity Framework current, but we really wanted to. Batching during save changes. So if I create a DB context, and then I update a couple of objects, and then I insert a few, and then I call save changes today. Let's say I update two records, and I insert three records. How many statements do I send to the database? Five. Every one of those things I just did is a different connect to the database, send a command, come back, right? Entity Framework Core batches all that together into a single statement and sends one statement to the database, comes back. Client evaluation in link queries is amazing. being able to send a query, link query to the database, and some of your link query is evaluated on the server and some of it is evaluated on the client, depending on what can and cannot happen. You were never really able to do this in any frameworks before, and there were all sorts of situations where it would have been super useful. If any of you have seen the error where you just get an exception in any framework where it can't translate your link query into SQL because the SQL primitives aren't there, right? So you'd be able to write a link query now where it'll translate what it can to SQL and then do the rest in memory. It might mean you pull back some extra data or something, but if it can't do it on the database anyway, you're not really losing that much, right? Shadow state properties, SQL Server sequence, alternate keys, like these are all features that are going to be added in EF Core that we kind of tried and wanted to add a lot in Entity Framework 6, but they were just getting too expensive to implement because they just weren't designed. The entire system wasn't architected with these concepts in mind. Okay, lightweight and extensible core. So this lightweight and extensible core is like a concept that I learned when I moved to America. Motherhood and apple pie, it's like something that you say that everybody agrees with that's amazing. So what this means for Entity Framework is there's a core set of APIs like metadata and like SQL generation, this says, but like generation for your native data store, change tracking, whole bunch of core concepts. And all of these concepts are built as a collection of services using the same kind of service provider and service collection. If any of you have used ASP.NET Core and some of that application model, a few of you, some of you have, I know you saw some of my talks, those same concepts flow into Entity Framework. So it both uses dependency injection for everything effectively and allows you to participate and do what you would like. If you don't like the SQL Server type mapper, the thing inside Entity Framework that decides how to map a bool to a bit inside SQL Server, or what, it's not actually that, it's what type should a bool become when you go to SQL, replace the SQL Server type mapper. Inherit from the SQL Server type mapper, replace the little bit you want, and then inject it, right? Which I'll show you a demo of later. So now you have this loosely coupled, this set of collection of services that Entity Framework is, in reality, with a surface of DB context on top for you to interact with it the same way that you've always interacted with it. But it means that whenever you want to peek under the covers or you want to be able to change something, then you can. Almost anything. I'm not even sure that I should caveat that with almost. I just assume that there's something that you can't replace, but I don't actually know that there is anything. As far as I know, everything can be. And we want to optimize for memory and CPU usage. So at the time that Entity Framework started, optimizing for memory and CPU usage wasn't actually that interesting a goal. Right? You bought a server, you had a server sitting inside your data center, you were paying for the same amount of money for it regardless of how much CPU and RAM it was using. Right? You weren't gaining interest on not on only using 10% of RAM, you weren't going to gain more RAM magically over the course of not using it. Right? However, with the rise of the cloud and the giant computer in the sky that is the cloud, suddenly CPU and RAM become really, really significant because I have to pay for them. And the amount that I use is directly proportional to the amount of money I have to spend on maintaining my server. So suddenly, CPU and memory, not even necessarily suddenly, but CPU and memory is significantly more important now than it historically was in our industry in general. Right? And then you have pay-for-pay components. We talked about being able to talk to table storage and Mongo and Redis and things like that. If you do not depend upon the SQL Server relational provider package, so you're not talking to SQL Server, there is absolutely nothing inside your application or in memory at any time that knows how to talk to a relational database. You're not paying for those types being loaded into memory. You're not paying for any code paths that may happen to be on the default path. You're only paying for what you've pulled in. Yeah? Okay, let's talk a little bit about EF Core and then it relates to Entity Framework 6. So when building Entity Framework Core, we wanted to be mindful of our past. We had a DB context, we had a programming model. The DB context programming model didn't suck, right? Or at least it didn't suck as much. It didn't suck so badly that we would have replaced it all with something completely new again that probably just sucks in different ways, right? It's actually really good. I like the DB context. So we wanted to make sure that we were mindful of keeping the existing stuff that we had that we decided to keep as much as possible, not just changing things for the sake of changing things. Here and there we did. Sometimes we changed some behaviors. where we thought it really made sense to change behaviors, but in general, the top how you interact with an entity framework is the same at the DB context level. But you can't be constrained by that. You can't, as I just said, we did change some things. We don't want to say because the add method did this in entity framework, it has to do exactly that same thing in entity framework core. So occasionally there were some behavior differences where we believed that the new behavior was significantly more intuitive and easy to understand than what the old behavior was. And all this stuff is listed on the EF wikis and EF documentation. It's a completely different core, so we needed to make sure that we could advantage of that. And because we were getting these new features that the current EF doesn't even know anything about, like batching and shadow state and stuff like that, there were just differences that are eventually going to happen. So, Entity Framework 6.x is a mature data stack. It's been going for a long time. People have been working on it consistently for that entire time. People have database providers that work for it. Right? Any of you not using SQL Server and one of the couple of data relational stores that we're going to have on 1.0 probably aren't going to be able to use EF Core until whoever owns the database provider for whatever crazy database you're using happens to make a provider, right? And whilst in EF Core, it should be significantly easier for them to make a provider because it's a lot easier to write providers for EF Core than it ever was for EF6. It still means that they're there for EF6. They're not going to be there for EF Core, at least not initially. You're still going to get patch and minor releases. You're going to get small features. You're going to get bug fixes. It's still going, right? The team has not abandoned the EF6 train. And EF Core is a true V1 in that we've deliberately scoped the V1 feature set and dropped some things that are important for an ORM. So EF6 will still be the right choice for some applications. And it's not an obvious decision about choosing one or the other. So you'll need to evaluate what you're trying to do and whether or not EF Core fits. The examples here are lazy loading and stored procedure mapping. They're just not going to be there for 1.0 of EF Core at all. If you really want lazy loading and stored procedure mapping, you can't use it. You'll have to use EF6 until they get added to Entity Framework Core. Right? And things like links translations, like there are examples where people have sent, there's link queries that are pages long that Entity Framework can somehow manage to make SQL for that performs terribly. There's a page of link, but it works. EDMX diagrams I remember being sent by customers that looked like motherboard circuit diagrams. And I couldn't print if I tried because they were too big. Right? These things that, whilst it may not have necessarily, some of these things would have caused performance problems, they functioned, and they just won't necessarily in EF Core, right? Maybe they will, maybe they won't, but these are the sorts of things. So the link translator in particular that we call out here is like, the link translator in EF Core is being rewritten, it's new. Whilst it can do a whole bunch of cool stuff that the old one couldn't do, there's probably a bunch of things that it needs work to keep getting better and better and better, and it'll take a little while before it does. So EF6 to EF Core is a port, not an upgrade. If you are using EF6 today, which it seems like a whole bunch of you are, if you're following along, if you're using DB context and you're just kind of letting EF generate all the SQL for you and generally not doing anything too custom, you're not really looking at any of the metadata, EF metadata stuff, maybe it'll be okay. But as soon as you're doing any of those things aren't true, then it'll start to get harder because they're parts of the stack that have changed. So you have to think of it as a porting to EF Core, not an upgrading to a major version, which is also why that name confusion earlier was kind of painful, kind of hurt the it hurt the explanation that I just gave you. Because if it was still called Entity Framework 7, and I would have come to you and said, hey, moving to Entity Framework 7 is a port, not an upgrade. And you would go, why can't I upgrade from Entity number 6 to number 7? Okay. Demos. Could I switch to number 1, please? Maybe. Yes, I can. Excellent. So, we're going to show some demos. This first demo, I was going to switch backwards and forwards between the slides to explain the demos, but we're just going to go through one giant run now because we can. This first demo is kind of an EF Core 101. For a bunch of you, I know there's at least some of you in the room that have never used EF Core at all, so I'm gonna give you a little bit of a taste of what that's like. Hopefully, it won't be too bad. So this is a model, this is a blog type that I'm gonna use in my blog context. And it looks like a blog class that has some properties exactly the same as you would expect, right? Then I have a blogging context, and I have a to-do here that says set up a database to connect to. So something that is a little bit different is that in the new model, you would create this on configuring that it takes a DB context options builder options, right? And then inside this on configuring method, so this is what I have with my DB set and my blog and my DB context. That's defining my data, my surface area for my data access. I can go context.blogs.add and save changes and such. But I need to tell EF now what database provider are you going to use? We don't even know whether or not it's a relational database provider anymore. So you need to tell EF some more things. So down here, you can see I have use SQL Server as an extension method on this options. Because if I didn't add the SQL Server package, I wouldn't have that use SQL Server. I'd have like use whatever the other package was that I added. Okay? And it's because not even connection string, like I know that in the case of SQL Server, I need to give it a connection string. So I can give it a, let's see, I have a connection string here, bloop, which is connecting to my local DB instance. Okay? But even that might not be common across many data stores. So this is the kind of thing that you end up doing if you are trying to build an early data access stack that can work with many stores. It's actually pretty nice given the given the amount of stuff that you potentially have to abstract. Okay, and then we're gonna do some data access. So I've already created an instance of my blogging context in here and I've created a blog. So I'm gonna go db.add and I'm gonna add my blog. Now here's something that's interesting. I just went db.add. Right? Does anybody see a problem with that? Yeah? dbblogs.add. Exactly. That's what I should do, db.blogs.add. But there is this new method now directly on DB context called add, and it'll work out. Because it's a blog and there's a collection of blogs, it probably has to go in the blog collection. So we'll do that for you. Right? But yes, .blogs.add. At the top level add is kind of useful if you don't necessarily know what the type is and a few other situations like that where that top level add might become useful. Okay, so we're gonna add a blog, and then we're gonna go like var blogs equals db.blogs dot, order by b dot, let's say name, something like that. Then we might go for each var b, in blogs, we're gonna do a loop. We're gonna go console.writeline, and we're going to write out our blog.name. .name. This feature is the most amazing thing C# has ever done. Yeah, excellent. Okay, now, am I missing anything? Save changes. See how great this is? db.saveChanges. Excellent. I'm missing one other thing. Thank you for reminding me about save changes, though. Very good. The other thing I'm missing is that I don't have... So the database this thing is trying to connect to right now is a... it's connecting to my local DB, and it's going demo.efcore101. And if I go and look, I have my local DB open here, and I don't have a demo.efcore101. So if I run this now, it's just going to throw an exception saying I can't connect to that database. If you're familiar with EF6, the way it used to work, you used to like magically get databases created for you on the fly and stuff like that in certain circumstances. That does not happen anymore. So I need to do something to create my database. And up here, I'm going to go like db.insureCreated, which is probably a terrible thing to do. Actually, I'm not going to go db.insureCreated because it's db.database.insureCreated. The abstraction over the top of the data store that I'm going to be talking to from my context. So ensure created is going to try and connect to my database. It's going to say, does the database exist? If it doesn't exist, it's going to go create the database for me, and then everything will be good. In the real world, you're going to use migrations, or you're going to use something else, any other way to create your database other than ensure created. For the sake of a For a stage demo, though, it seems fine. Wait a minute. Did I just not get any output onto the screen? Maybe I didn't. So now I have this database. I have EFCore 101, so it's created my database for me. It's created my blog table. It's created me my columns. So this is all looking pretty familiar, I hope, in terms of what you would expect to get from this context. Did it put data in my database? It put data in my database. Excellent. OK? Cool. So that's how you would do basic data access with EFCore. Make sense? Cool. Skipping along. Because I'm assuming, as always, I'm spending too much time talking and not enough time giving you demos. Performance. Who here really, really wants to see Entity Framework 6 compared to Entity Framework Core? Excellent. Luckily for you, we have just the thing. There's a couple of things that are super interesting in this demo. The first are these two folders. One of them is an Entity Framework Core. The other one is Entity Framework 6. Both of these frameworks can live inside the same project and run and work. They do have two completely different worlds of models, though, in this case. So I have a couple of things set up in this main method. I have a reset and warm-up, which just resets my database and makes sure that everything's jittered and stuff. I have this run test helper method that accepts some funks, and it basically executes those and times how long they took, and then at the end gives you a percentage difference. Hopefully, a percentage improvement only. Let's find out. So the first thing I'm going to do is I have this. This is connecting to the AdventureWorks database, the sample database. So the first thing I'm going to do is go like db.customers.toList. This, I can't remember how many. I think there's about 19,000 odd rows in this table. So we're just going to say, yeah, 19,000 rows into memory seems like a good idea. Let's do this. Go. Okay. And we're going to see three iterations. And it'll tell us how long it took for EF6 and how long it took for EFCore. How's that look? Does that look pretty good? Yeah, you can clap for that. So outside of the ridiculous gains that you got here was that Entity Framework Core got better after the first run. And that's mostly due to caching, query caching and stuff like that. Yeah, what's up? Am I what? Can I try to build it on release? I could. Why? Do you think that'll make it go faster? Of course. Probably will. But I'm not going to. Not right now. Realistically, I don't think it has that much impact on that part of the, this part of the stack. It might, but I think the difference is negligible. Okay, so now I'm going to drag in a more complicated query. Maybe a for EF. I don't know. Anyway, what we're going to do here is say, get me all the accounts that end with 1. We're going to order by account number. We're going to go by modified date, skip 100, group by territory ID, do a bunch of stuff for no apparent reason. I don't even know what all that stuff means. Just going to run it. Now, so this is just showing just yet another query, something that looks a little bit more realistic, though, and what impact we have. Look good? Okay. Is this going to break it? I don't know. I realized I don't know what impact changing it to release has on perf, so I thought I might as well try it since he asked. Yeah. What are you trying to do to me, man? Okay. I don't think if it changes to release makes it work, so I think you're just seeing random variation in the numbers on my laptop. Okay, so let's pull in another thing. Let's pull in, I think this snippet has using inside of it, so let's pull in add and save 1,000. Okay? So we're going to, this is fairly naive. Some of you probably know ways that this could be improved. Put your hand up if you know a way how this, do you think this could be improved already? Those of you who are familiar with using EF6 and working around or with its implementation details. So we're basically, huh? Add range, well done, sir. Top of the class. Oh, no, I have a compilation error. Oh, yeah, that. So this needs to go to EF Core, because I'm trying to add an EF6 model to an EF6 thing, Control F5. Yes, exactly, I can do add range, and I'm not going to, just to make EF6 look as bad as humanly possible. Then I'll go and change it to add range so you'll be able to see the difference. Okay? So how's that? It's looking pretty good. That's inserting 1,000 records. And look at the thing to note about this is the massive difference on iteration 1 and 2 versus 0 for Entity Framework Core. This is like the caching that Entity Framework Core does that EF6 doesn't, having a massive impact on subsequent runs of the same query in the same context. Okay, so yeah, we can do stuff like you just said. We can say var c equals new EF6 dot product categories of the things we're adding, right? We can make 1,000 of them. And we can say ECI, right? Basically build an array. We can say CI equals new category. I think that. Right? And then we can say DB dot, what are we saying? Product categories dot add range. And then we can add C. Yeah? Does that look better to you? The add range guy? Yeah? Okay. I can't see anybody, so I'm not actually sure if I'm even looking in the right direction. But I'm going to leave EF Core to just be EF Core and be naive and simple, because that code looks a lot better to me than that top one. There you go. So if you work around, if you know enough to do add range and to, oh, that's one thing I missed. So two things. First, that -9% seems to happen for the first time only for some reason on this particular laptop and not on other laptops. And the other thing that you can do with Entity Framework is turn off change tracking with the EF6, but it doesn't actually make that much difference in this case. The numbers look about exactly the same as they did there, where the first iteration looks roughly the same. You get between -5 and +5 on this particular machine. On other machines, I've seen EF6 never ever beat EF Core in that first run. On this machine, you happen to get -5 to +5 difference if you know enough to do add range when you're doing lots of inserts. But then the subsequent ones are always still faster, as we saw when we ran, because the caching improvements for EF Core start to dwarf everything else. Right? So you're still at 15-20% improvements. Okay, cool. Does that look good? Yeah? Okay, metadata. Who here has had to use the metadata APIs in Entity Framework? The looking at entity metadata, like working out what table my type is mapped to, things like that? A couple of you? Sorry. So, for those of you who have not, it looks something like this. Does that look intelligible? You basically need to go get a thing called an object context. You need to get the object context. You need to get a thing called metadata workspace. You need to get the O space collection. Then you need to loop through a bunch of things called entities. Or you need to get to entities from O space. Then you need to go and do a whole bunch of link queries on those different things in order to eventually be able to map the CLR type to a table type. Okay? We're going to do the same thing in EF Core. The way that you do this in EF Core is you go for each. And you go var entity in db dot, seems like having a thing called like model here on db context that is the model for my stuff might be useful. And then I can say like get entities maybe, get entity types. And then I can go like entity, let's say console dot write line. And I'm gonna say, use the best feature in the world again, entity dot CLR type, right? I'll get this thing out of the way for you. So I'm basically saying, tell me this, take the CLR type, then tell me what the default table name for that CLR type would be. So like if you were to go create my database for me, what would you call the table for this type, right? Now, the interesting thing about that is we talked earlier about how do I get table name from this entity type given that table name is like SQL Server construct, or at least it's a construct specific to the store that I happen to be using. Table name doesn't make sense necessarily if I'm using MongoDB or Redis, right? So I instead have this extension method. This comes from my provider now to say, tell me the SQL Server dot table name, right? That is the equivalent of that. And then, at this point, I make up something to say for a little while about how blazingly fast Entity Framework can be. And then Entity Framework Core is really quick. The reason that the EF6 is really slow there is it's not actually connecting to the database. And in order to access the model information quickly within Entity Framework, with current Entity Framework, you have to actually be able to connect to the database. In this case, neither of these code paths were connecting to the database. It's just that EF Core is significantly better at being able to build this model without a database connection. It doesn't actually need it at all. It can work out what it would do without actually talking to the database first. Okay? So you can, if you ran this demo and you were letting EF6 talk to the database, then it would probably be similarly fast. I don't think this is necessarily a judgment on that. And I also didn't put like dot type name in there, so I've got the output is slightly different, unfortunately, just because I didn't type the right thing at the top. If we did like dot name here, it would be better. It would say the same. Okay, is that cool? Doesn't seem that demo is only impactful for like the couple of you who have actually found the need to use the metadata APIs. They're fairly, we hope, like at least in EF, current EF, they're very niche. Like most people don't end up needing them. When you do need them, you need them for something pretty specific most of the time. But they still can be super cool to be able to model, to be able to actually programmatically look at the model that EF is using and like examine it and make decisions or look at it, right? That stuff can be super powerful. Okay, so here I have a new console application called Consuming Services. And what we're gonna do in here is we're going to grab the type that Entity Framework uses to map CLR types to like column types, to map CLR types to SQL Server types in this case. We're gonna get that thing out and we're gonna use it to just pull some data and show some stuff in the console, right? So internally, SQL Entity Framework, there's this type which you can call get mapping on it. You give it a CLR type, it gives you back what type in the database that CLR type should have. So you can say, tell me what DB type this bool is, and it'll tell you bit, right? Or tell me what this string should map to, and it'll say like n bar char, right? So the first thing we need to do is get a service provider. So what we're gonna do is say var service provider equals, and we're gonna say db.getInfrastructure. This is a way that you can get hold of the service provider that Entity Framework uses internally to resolve all the dependencies it needs to be able to do its own stuff. From there, you can say type mapper equals service provider.getService. And we're gonna say iRelational type mapper, because it could be, assuming I'm using a relational database, some form of relational database, it's gonna have an iRelational type mapper. It might not be a SQL Server. There is also an explicit type called the SQL Server type mapper, which is the one we happen to be using in this case, but one might not be, so I'm gonna get the interface. Then here I'm gonna say type mapper.name, so we know what type it is. It should tell you like SQL Server type mapping or something like that. And then we're gonna say, over here, we're gonna say type mapper, tell me what, get the mapping for a type of bool, right? And then tell me what its default type name is in the database. Does that make sense to everybody? I'm just using this type to say, giving it some CLR primitives and saying, CLR primitives, giving it some types and saying, tell me what you think these should map to in the database. Right? So now I've spun up my context. I've said, give me the type mapper. And I've just decided to use it however I want to use it. And in this case, I've said, tell me what you would map a bool to and tell me what you would map an mvar char to. A string to, and this is the output. And I know that the implementation of that interface in this case is SQL Server type mapper. If I was to use SQLite, it would be a SQLite type mapper because the SQLite types are gonna be different to the SQL Server types, right? Cool, does that make sense to everybody? Okay. Either yes or it's stunned silence, but that's okay. Okay, so let's look at something that's kind of cool, being able to grab like Entity Framework types and being able to like mess with them and do stuff. But what's a little bit more interesting is being able to say, I want you to use the SQL Server type mapper that I'm going to implement. And I wanted you to do what I tell you to do. Okay? So what we have in this demo is we have the same kind of blogging context. I have a blog type. But in this case, it has this marker attribute. This is just a straight up attribute that doesn't do anything. All it's there for is so that I can write code that says if a property has this attribute later on. So I have this string called metadata. It happens to be XML, but I model it as a string in my domain. But when it's in the database, I want it to actually use the XML data type inside SQL Server. Okay? Now I could do that by like going in my DB context, I could do the user Fluent API and say this is XML and stuff like that. For the sake of this example, we're gonna go and replace the SQL Server type mapper so that if any property anywhere has the XML attribute, it gets saved as XML in the database. Okay? Now, a slight caveat is that the reason that I can get away with doing this is because ADO already actually knows how to turn strings into XML data types, so I don't really have to do very much. There is a future feature, which would be you being able to write code like what I'm writing to kind of arbitrarily serialize stuff to whatever format you want it to be in, but that's not a thing that exists right now. Okay, so in here, this is my custom SQL Server type mapper. I've inherited from SQL Server type mapper, and I've created this thing called a relational type mapping. All this is doing is saying, all this type does is represent the mapping of like my CLR type to my whatever the DB type is going to be. And this class is responsible, everything inside EF is going to resolve this from its service provider, and whenever it needs to know how to map one type to another in the database, it's going to call get mapping. So in here, what I'm going to do is say if property dot has CLR attribute, which is in my own extension method where I just hid the reflection code that goes and looks to see whether or not this has this thing on it. Then I want you to return my underscore XML type mapping. And my underscore XML type mapping says map string to XML. Okay, that's what this here says, map string to type XML. Okay, so now I have a custom SQL Server type mapper, and I have my blog context. I have my blog, so it has the XML marker attribute to say this is going to be XML. And I have my context, but I haven't told anyone anywhere to replace the internal, the default SQL Server type mapper with the custom one yet. So let's do that. We're going to make a constructor, and we're going to accept in here an iService provider. And then we're going to pass that into the base of EF. And what this is basically doing here, the base class of the DB context. So what I'm doing here is saying when somebody news you up, they're going to give you a service provider, you're going to use that to resolve all of your types from, however they got it. So that means if you're using AutoFac, and AutoFac has an iService provider mapping, which it will do, which it has, I don't know if it works right now, but which it will have, then you'll be able to go and tell AutoFac, give me a service provider from all the stuff it knows about, however you've configured AutoFac, and then pass that into EF, and then EF is using AutoFac to resolve its types the way you configured it up at the top, right? Same as you can with like ASP.NET Core. Okay, so now we're renewing up our context here, but we don't have a service provider, so we're going to create one. So the way you create service providers is you create a new service collection, which is the type. This service collection is the type you get inside your configure services method inside an ASP.NET Core app, for those of you who have been doing that. And then we go sc.add entity framework, and then we go dot like add SQL Server, because we're adding SQL Server types as well. And then what we're going to do is say service collection dot add singleton, and we're going to add a singleton service, and it's type SQL Server type mapper. And we're going to replace that with our custom SQL Server type mapper type. So now when anybody, now the DI system is basically going to take care of making sure there's only ever one custom SQL Server type mapper, and it's always going to be given to anybody who ever tries to resolve to use it. And now I'm going to go var service provider equals sc.build provider, which gives me a service provider from a service collection. Once the service provider is, the difference here is the service collections are immutable, you can change them around. Once you call build, the service provider can't be changed. Once it's handed off to somebody, that's it, it doesn't get changed. So now we pass SP into here, And then, now we're gonna go Control F5 and hope I didn't forget anything. Yeah? So, what we can see here straight away is we're using custom SQL Server type mapper. If we go look at my console out, we resolved type mapper from EF the same way that, from the DB context, the same way that we were before. So when we asked EF to give us its type mapper, it gave us the one we asked for. But string is still mapped to nvarchar because by default string is still mapped to nvarchar. It's only strings that have our special attribute that are marked to XML. But now if we go in here to our back to our database and we refresh here, and we look at the replacing services demo database that just got created when we did that, and we look at the columns for my blog, you can see that metadata is of type XML. Because when EF was asking for what type that column should be, they mapped it to XML. And if I go look at the blog entry we just had, it's XML, right? And the owner is Rowan because Rowan wrote this demo. Now, can I switch back to the other output, output 3, please? Okay, so some of the reason that we did some of that, you can't see what I'm seeing. Okay. Yeah, I guess we just switch back. So what I was about to show you, which doesn't matter, it was kind of a brief interlude, was with Entity Framework Core, with this console application, we had to go create a service collection, create a service provider. If you're in an ASP.NET Core app, what I was going to show you was in the same demo, basically the same stuff running on a Mac with inside an ASP.NET Core app. In ASP.NET Core, there is a section for you to configure service collections. So when you're inside the ASP.NET Core application model, inside your configure services method, you go services.entityFramework, and then you pass your service, and then your entity framework can pick it all up for you. Okay, so if your application model happens to know about service collections and service providers, there can be other ways to configure stuff without you going and newing up a service collection and doing things on your own. But Entity Framework has to work in all the application models that don't have that for them, so they have other ways of doing things as well. Okay? Now, the other thing that we want to talk about when replacing services is that Entity Framework has, there's layers of services. So when we said add Entity Framework and add SQL Server here to our service collection, we're adding Entity Framework is adding the core services, state manager, the compiled query cache, all these sorts of things that are kind of common. When you say add SQL Server, that's when you start getting all the database provider specific, that's where you're getting SQL Server specific services, SQL Server type mapper, SQL Server code generation, all that sort of stuff is going to come from that extension method. And that all plays back into like how we get pay for play, because we don't add types if you don't need them, and how everything layers. And then on top of all that is like this top level surface area API, which is a DB context, which you kind of get everywhere as well. Right? But that stuff you don't need services for. Okay, let's have a look at something else. Okay, so I have here now a note taker application. It is incredibly complicated. It has a UWP application, which can let you write some text and save it to a database. And it has a portable class library here called NoteTaker. Now, inside the portable class library is where my DB context is and my note type is. And that's shared between this NoteTaker modern application and another thing that we're about to talk about in part two, cleverly hidden behind this part two folder, which we'll look at in a minute. So, what we're going to do is, inside this new note page, we have a save click. Actually, I think we're going to do some DB context stuff, some note context stuff first. Okay, so up here in my DB context, in my common portable library, I've got my own configuring method. Now, the way this application works is it's a UWP application, so it needs to be able to store stuff locally. So I want to use some sort of database technology where I can store stuff locally to my device. So what I'm going to do here is say options builder.use SQLite instead of using SQL Server. because in this application, I have added the SQLite database provider package. I've also got SQL Server, but that's only for the next demo. I don't actually need it to do this part. So we're going to say file name, because this is the connection string complexity of a SQLite database. It's a little bit more easy to read than the other one for a SQL Server. So we're going to say use SQLite. I think that's about all up here for our DB context. We're just saying use notes. And again, it goes into like a crazy cache folder thing somewhere under when you run UWP applications. But any framework takes care of making sure it goes into the right spot relatively when it's a relatively path, if possible. Now, we have an existing notes page in this app, which goes and does queries. It says notes, give me some notes. And then we have a new note page, which we haven't got any code for. So now in here, what I need to do, I need to add this note that we just created from the UI, and we need to put it into our SQLite database. So this looks incredibly familiar to you. It should, at least. There's new notes context, right, or note context. And then we go db.notes.add. We've already got a note. We're going to add the note to our context. And then we're going to go db.saveChanges. So what I'm trying to bring home with this is one of the advantages of EF being everywhere is that now the programming model that we were familiar with in all those console applications we just wrote works in a UWP app, works in a console app. So now UWP apps work all over the place. So the last thing I need to do is I don't necessarily have a database for this thing, so up here in my app, I'm going to go db.ensureCreated again. Remember that do as I say, not as I do, and don't go and do this code yourself. Find some other way of creating a database, please. Because In this case, this might be okay. Because you're a UWP application, it's a local file system database. The database has to be created on the device. You can't create it any other way. So maybe it's okay to do something in here, but you could programmatically maybe run migrations or something against it too, I'm not sure. But anyway, think about how you're gonna create your database is my more meta point. Don't naively do some things that are going to potentially bite you later. And do not come to me asking why your web application takes a really long time to start up when you're creating the database inside the startup method, please. Okay, so. I didn't mean to do this yet, but I just ran this and it like started some sort of surfacey kind of emulatory thing. And I can like type in here and I guess I click save down here and but I can't because, you know, can't click save. So instead, we change this to local machine. I'm gonna control F5. If I had a phone emulator on here, I could control F5 this into a phone emulator and the same application would run on my phone. So now it's running on my local machine and I can take some notes. And I can look at the notes that are inside my notes database. And if I open up Windows Explorer, I think I have this saved. It saves this notes database in like this crazy like GUID folder somewhere in here for UWP applications. But so now you've got this same programming model and it works on a Windows phone and it works on like an Xbox and it works on all these other devices where UWP apps run. But unless you are significantly different to all the other people in the world that I have seen listen to this talk, your applications probably look a little bit more like this. Yeah? So let's look at what it looks like now. We've completely changed paradigms again. We're now in Windows Forms. So we want to say, okay, let's make a Windows Forms. Now, this is the exact same context that I just ran inside my UWP app. Like, it's the actual same code. This notes context.cs. Okay, so now in here, in my main form, in my add method, I'm gonna say, let's make some notes. So I'm gonna say using var db equals new note context. And then I'm gonna say db.notes.add. Man, this is looking familiar. db.saveChanges to go to the database. And that's all. Right? Looking good? And I'm already doing an ensure created up here. So now, if I control F5 my Windows Forms application, now I can take some new notes. Yeah? See? Yeah. Cool. So now I can take a couple of notes. Okay, that's interesting. So now, You have the same DB context, like data access paradigm. You can use it on UWP applications, Windows Forms applications. You can use it in console applications. You'll be able to use it in ASP.NET Core applications. You'll be able to use it in the Xamarin iOS type stuff. Like you're getting to the point where you can kind of use the same DB context, how do I access data paradigms everywhere you end up needing to get data. Yeah. Don't I want to what? Sorry?
To use another connection.
A different connection string? Notes.db is relative to where my app is. So in the case of my Windows Forms application, it's inside like bin debug. Or am I in debug still? Yeah. I have like notes is here now. Okay. Next to my app, right? Sure, yeah, okay, let's talk about some of that. I'm gonna talk about something that's only vaguely related to that, but I'll mention it again as we hit it, okay? So yes. Now, the next thing that I wanna talk about with this demo is the type note has a property on it called isUploaded. So what we're gonna do here is we're gonna kind of fake having a central server where we upload all the notes to from all of your devices. And the central server is gonna be SQL Server. But the local database is going to be SQLite. So now we're going to use that same notes context that we just used using SQLite, and we're going to instead configure it to use SQL Server when I'm connecting to a remote server, and SQLite when I don't want to connect to a SQLite database. And then we're going to run it, and then we're going to go and upload all of our notes to our remote server, which in this case is going to be a local DB database. Okay? So, inside on our main form, we have, first of all, let's display our is uploaded column. Let's go make it read only. We call add, close. All right. Does that clapping mean I'm running out of time? Is that what that means? And then, not running out of time. I am. Okay. 3 o'clock. Right. That's when this ends. Okay. And now I'm going to go over to my file upload to central database. And in here, I have a query which says, grab some data from my local DB, and then get all the notes that haven't been uploaded, and then pull a connection string from my configuration manager and put it into a variable. Okay? And then I'm going to go var DB. What am I going to do? I'm going to go using. No. Let's go change this first. Inside our notes context, what I'm going to do is I'm going to add a new constructor that accepts a note context, and it is going to accept DB context options, and then it's going to pass that straight into our base class, right? And then over in our main form, so then the thing with this is saying, if I give you an options in the constructor, I want you to use that. But even if you pass an options in the constructor, EF is still going to call on configuring, just in case you want to do something extra to the one that was passed in. So in this case, we don't want to do that. So we're going to say if options builder.is configured already. So if somebody has not, sorry, we need an exclamation mark. If somebody has not already configured this thing, then I want you to use SQLite with our relative notes.file. But if you have already passed me something in, I don't want you to do this. Just do whatever that thing says. And then over in our upload, we're going to create a new var options builder. We're going to create a new instance of that DB context option that get passed in equals new DB context options. And we're going to say options.useSQLServer DB context options builder. Yeah, thank you, sir. And then we're going to say builder.useSQLServer in this case. We know it needs a connection, and we've got a connection string, which we've been much better about getting from somewhere reasonable instead of hard coding. And then we're going to say using var db equals new note context, and we're going to give it options builder.options, and we're going to say db.addRange. And we're going to say new notes, and then we're going to say db.saveChanges. All right? And then We are going to... Now, the other thing we have to do is, just for the sake of a demo, I'm going to do this in here as well. Because I don't think I actually already have the notes database in my local DB, and I probably need to go create it. So we're going to go and control F5 this, and then we're going to go file up here, and we're going to say upload to central database. And this is going to take a while, just a little while. The reason it's going to take a little while is because I don't actually have that database, so it needs to go and create my notes database. There's even more clapping. Oh, no. Okay, yeah, so now it's created my notes taker database. It's created my table. I have my note database. I can select top 1,000. It's inserted the data into my local thing, and it said it's uploaded to notes. So now I have the same context working in a UWP application and a Windows Forms application, and it can connect to SQLite, and it can connect to SQL Server, depending on how you use it. All right? Okay. Now, I have how much time left? Excellent, I'm over on 6 minutes, that seems perfect. Okay, so there are some more demos for people who you want, if you want to be able to see them. But otherwise, thank you very much for joining me. The places to go see stuff, apparently my other computer doesn't work, so I can't give you links, but docs.efproject.net, github.com/aspnet/entity-framework. And if you want to go and rerun all of this stuff yourself, there is github.com/RowanMiller/demo-efcore. Is where this talk is, because this is an open source talk, which means anybody who wants to can go and grab everything that I just showed you, all of the demos, the slides, a complete script on how to set up your machine to be able to run them the same way I just did, and you could go give the talk yourself if you really want to. Huh? I can by doing this, I suppose. Which one? All of them? The GitHub one? This is the demo one. Shunk. Okay? Unfortunately, I didn't get the one thing I didn't get the chance to show you was that performance demo. I was going to go back to that performance demo, and I was going to insert 1,000 rows into an Azure database. And the Azure database is actually about 100% faster because of the batching differences that we make. Oh, well. Yeah. Thank you.